Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Michigan Literary Network Radio for Wednesday, June 22nd, 2015. I got thrown off because I didn't hear my applause. I'm Andrea Daniel, and today we're going to talk a little bit about when a book goes from hardcover to paperback, and we'll replay my previously recorded interview with the Turner House author, Angela Flournoy, whose book recently was released in paperback. And that's coming up right after this quick break.
You're listening to the Michigan Literary Network radio show hosted by Motown Writers Network. Thank you for joining us. Motown Writers connects writers to their literary goals and readers to Michigan authors. For writers, we have workshops, conferences, networking opportunities, marketing, and promotions, plus resources available online and offline. We invite writers of all stages to our free writers discussions meetings held every second Saturday except in November at the Barnes & Noble's on Wayne State University campus from 10 a.m. to noon. For readers, we provide literary entertainment, book news, and giveaways online and offline. Check out our website for more information at MotownWriters.com. The Michigan Literary Network and Motown Writers annual events offline include the Essence of Motown Literary Conference and Jam, held every second Saturday in November. Also, our literary meet and greet is held in August of every year. Along with that, we have a book club mix and mingle in October. At these events, we invite readers and writers to come together to celebrate the written word, and at most events, they are free to readers. If you're interested in being a guest on our radio show, advertising with us, or promoting your literary project or service, please visit us at MotownWriters.com and click on our contact page for more information. If you're interested in hosting your own show with the Michigan Literary Network, please submit your show proposals to MotownWriters@Yahoo.com. Please share our information with other readers and writers, and we hope you help us continue to strengthen the literary network in Michigan and increase literacy in the Metro Detroit community. For more information, please visit our website at www.michiganliterarynetwork.com.
And this is Michigan Literary Network Radio for June 22nd, 2016. We're going to talk a little bit about when a book goes from hardcover to paperback in traditional publishing instances. And we'll replay my previously recorded interview with the Turner House author, Angela Flournoy, whose book recently was released in paperback. So on March 7th of this year, Angela posted this comment on Instagram. I can't believe the novel has been out for nearly a year, but it has, and the paperback is in stores now. The Turner House in hardcover was traditionally published by Houghton Mifflin Hardcore on April 14, 2015, and quickly became a National Book Award finalist, with a host of other accolades to mention. It was nominated for the NAACP Image Awards Outstanding Literary Work Debut Author, finalist for the Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers Award, finalist for the New York Public Library Young Lions Fiction Award, shortlisted for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, shortlisted for the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize for Debut Fiction, shortlisted for the Ernest Gaines Award, longlisted for the NBCC John Leonard Prize for a debut novel, an Amazon Top 100 Editors Pick of the Year, a Michigan Notable Book 2016, Black Caucus of the ALA First Novelist Award winner, a New York Times Notable Book Award Book of the Year, and a New York Times Editor's Choice Pick. So why does the hardcover come out before the paperback? And how long does it take for the paperback to be released? I did a little research to find the answers, and here's what I found. One factor is price discrimination, I read. Those who want to buy a book as soon as it comes out want the book more than those who just want to read it eventually. By releasing the hardcover first, the publisher can extract a lot of value from impatient readers. Meanwhile, patient readers aren't turned off by the high price because they can eventually buy it at a more reasonable price later. By offering hardcovers first, the publisher segments its customers and can offer a higher price to those with higher demand. And about the time frame between the hardcover release and the paperback release, here's what Andrew Zack says, who is a literary agent and freelance editor and also president of the Zack Company. The rule of thumb used to be 12 months, but as the hard soft model grew, in which the same publisher publishes a title first in hardcover and then paperback versus licensing the paperback rights, that time has often been extended or shortened, as in Angela's case. Now it can take far longer than a year, and in some cases, years, especially if the hardcover continues to sell. Both Cold Mountain and the Da Vinci Code took about over 2 years and perhaps longer before the paperback came out. Professional and academic titles often only are hardcover editions because the marketplace will support their continued sale in that format. Most commercial fiction and nonfiction does eventually get a paperback edition, but not all, as sometimes the sales of the hardcover are so poor that it just seems like throwing good money after bad to publish the paperback. So, Angela Flournoy's book, The Turner House, which is about an East Side Detroit family, was released as a paperback about a year after its hardcover release. The paperback cover design is different than the hardcover design, but the content is still award-winning, and we congratulate Angela Flournoy for going into the paperback edition. And so let's take a listen to my February 2016 interview with Angela Flournoy talking about her book, The Turner House. Hello, welcome, welcome. Thank you for calling in. I'm so glad you're here.
I'm happy to be here.
Very good, thank you. I've got some things I want to talk about with you. One of the things I want to start off with is when you open up the leaf of the book, the first thing on the inside jacket reads, "Meet the Turners, a big, complicated, loving, feuding, vibrant family." That's a bit of a mouthful. Tell us a little bit more about this book. I was able to read some of the description of the book, but in your words, tell us what it's about.
My novel is set in 2008 in Detroit, and it's really the story of a family and their history with the house on the east side of the city, but also their history with each other and the story of how the family migrated from the south to the city.
Mm. Now, is it loosely based on your own family?
Well, my father is from Detroit, and I am from a big family, so those things are similar to my family story.
Okay, okay. So how did the idea come to you to do this particular story? I mean, did you maybe just wake up one day and say, hey, I wanna write a book that I'm drawing some information from my family, some information from Detroit? How did that come about?
The idea was really a combination of just a couple of things that I've been interested in for a while. And so one of them is just the idea of home ownership. So I started thinking about this book in 2009, which, you know, we were still very much in like the national sort of housing crisis. I wanted to think about, so I was basically just thinking about how people who live in the city of Detroit have been experiencing what we were seeing sort of on the news on a national level. They'd been experiencing that for over a decade. On like a smaller level, just like the rapid devaluation of your home and how that can kind of upset your ideas about the future and about place, et cetera. So that was one of it. But really, it started with one character, the youngest Turner child, Layla. I just pictured this house that like no one else in her family wanted to live in anymore on the east side. What sort of person might want to live in that house? And the character of Layla, who we find out pretty early on in the book is addicted to gambling, was that person.
Ah, okay. Now, I love
in the beginning of the book that there is a family tree. Tell me how that particular aspect of the book came about and how you actually created it.
Well, the family tree was really like literally the last thing that I created for the book. And it was something that my editor thought would be a good idea to help orient people and to help them understand just the scope of the family. So all those characters don't necessarily appear, but certainly the 13 children do appear and some of the grandchildren appear. But it's just a way to help readers get like a scope of how big the family is and sort of how many, even though it seems like there's only three or four generations within there because of the range of years, it's actually like smaller generations.
I love that point. It kind of, it really personalizes the story so that you can see all the branches and all who's in here because you've got, you know, such a big family to go through for the story.
Yes. So hopefully I think also it can be something that readers, when they're reading, they can keep going back for reference points.
Yep. And so you've got a lot of history in the novel. There's family history and Detroit history. How did you go about blending the two histories into the storyline? Because it's so interesting how it's woven so nicely in.
Well, I'm a big proponent of sort of character coming first. So like as I said, the book started because I finally had a character. So the information that's in there about like the history of Detroit, I really tried to make it feel organic and sort of necessary in relationship to whatever character. So like for instance, the eldest son, he used to work at the Lynch Road assembly plant. So there's history about that plant and about what kind of cars he used to build because it's also important to him and his identity. You know, that was a place, like his first job.
Okay. And so just a little bit how you said your father is from Detroit, and you were born where? Where are you from, actually?
I'm from Los Angeles.
From Los Angeles, okay. So you have some knowledge. You would come to Detroit to visit at certain times. Tell us about your relationship with Detroit in addition to it being your father's hometown.
Well, Detroit is a city that I've gone throughout my life, and I've always associated with warmth because I have a lot of family there and sort of pride and really like good food, and I've always had a good time. So it was really kind of jarring as I got older and lived in other places to realize that people don't have that association with the city. And that was one thing that bothered me and that I wanted to sort of explore in my book was just the way that, like, people who have never been to Detroit but, you know, live in this country or live in the world, they have one expectation for the city, and that the city is actually a lot more diverse and complex and multifaceted than I think a lot of people understand.
Okay, so was that kind of like an underlining mission for you writing this story?
Yeah, you could say that.
Were there any challenges, Angela, that you had to overcome while writing the story?
Honestly, probably the biggest challenge in the story itself is just organization, because I have a lot of characters and just trying to figure out like whose story is really like the most important and who are we going to kind of return to the most, and other people kind of become secondary or like tertiary characters. But personally, it was really just like making ends meet. I had a lot of different jobs while I was working on the book.
Okay, so it was a whole bunch of things involved, but that organization part is something that you mentioned, and I've seen, you know, a lot of different ways that authors handle keeping things together, keeping their characters together, keeping the storyline together. What was your particular process in making, you know, in keeping organized to make sure your people were where, you know, for continuity, the people and the place and the history continuity? How did you keep everything together? Did you have a certain method, sticking things up on the wall, a booklet, you know, a notebook? How did you do that? Because you had a lot to deal with.
Yeah, I definitely kept like lists of all the names and ages and relationships. I had a cork board, so I had them like on index cards. But I also had a notebook.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just kept a lot in my head as well.
Okay. So I think now would be a good time, if you're able, do you have the book there with you and can you read an excerpt from it?
Sure. I'm just going to read the first paragraph and a half.
Okay.
The very beginning.
Okay, thank you.
Called Trouble in the Big Room. The eldest six of Francis and Viola's 13 children claimed that the big room of the house on Yarrow Street was haunted for at least one night. A ghost, a haint, if you will, tried to pull Cha-Cha out of the big room's second-story window. The room was not, in actuality, very big, could hardly be considered a room. For some other family, it might have made a decent storage closet or a mother's cramped sewing room. For the Turners, it became the only single occupancy bedroom in their overcrowded house, a rare and coveted space. It was the summer of 1958. Cha-Cha, the eldest at 14 years, was in the throes of a gangly-legged, croaky-voiced adolescence. Smelling himself is what Viola called it. Tired of sharing a bed with younger brothers who peed and kicked and drooled and blanket hogged, Cha-Cha woke up one evening, untangled himself from his brother's errant limbs, and stumbled into the whatnot closet across the hall. He slept on the floor, curled up with his back against dusty boxes, and started a tradition. From then on, one Turner child got grown and gone, as Francis described it. The next eldest child crossed the threshold into the big room. I'll stop there.
Oh, wow. Okay. I really wanted you to go on. I'm so glad that you picked this particular section because I think I kind of wanted you to read this anyway. So thank you for that. And what a vivid description, and there's very vibrant and vividness in the storytelling of this. I just absolutely love it. And, you know, with this section, on the leaf on the inside of the jacket, one of the things that it said is there ain't no Hanks in Detroit. And so to start off with that particular section of the book, I really love that. Where did you have to go to pull this bit of information out? Is that something that is actually, did you pull that from real life or is this from Angela's imagination?
Well, I've heard stories about Hanks growing up, usually from older people in my family, and most of those stories were sort of set in the South. So I was interested in kind of one of the things this book is like a great migration story in some ways. And so I'm interested in the things that, you know, when Black people moved from the South to the North, what sort of traditions and beliefs and customs lingered, and which ones did we let go of? And so this ghost, I'm just interested in sort of having it be something that sort of follows the family from the South to the North and having people, characters who think, you know, they're not superstitious, they don't believe in this sort of thing, still have to deal with it, still have to sort of contend with it. So that's kind of where that came from.
Right. Okay. Well, that is just wonderful, wonderful. And I had the privilege of hearing you talk at the Detroit Women's Leadership Network Coffee with Women Writers at Trainosos 2 weeks ago. And you mentioned during that conversation that during the process of writing and publishing the book, that in talking with publishers and agents, you had to fight for yourself and know the answers for your own work. I think that's such an important point. Can you talk a little bit about that so our listeners can know, you know, how the importance of these particular aspects?
Yeah, I think it's just one of the things that happens when you are interested in publishing a book is that people ask you, sometimes they're just making conversation, but sometimes they really are interrogating the decisions you've made on every level of the book. And so if you're not sure why you've made the decision, like, for instance, why do you have a ghost, you might, you know, come across an editor who thinks this book would sell more without a ghost, so you need to get rid of it. So you really have to have an idea of why you've made the decisions that you've made and which ones you're willing to compromise. And which things are, like, not, you know, they're not on the table as far as bargaining. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't think about ahead of time and then find themselves sort of blindsided by having to defend or just explain.
Okay. So when in going into the process, when these questions were coming at you, did you know ahead of time? It's like, oh, I need to know the answers to a lot of questions that are going to come to me, so I have to have index cards. You know, how did you work that out? Because it's interesting that particular thing that comes up.
Well, I think one of the things, I went to graduate school. I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop. I got a master's in fine arts. But in writing workshops, that's one of the things that, like, you're learning. Because people will, you know, say, I don't think you should have made that decision. I don't think this should happen. I think this should happen instead. So one of the things you're learning just by, like, listening to this feedback is, like, what you agree with and what you don't with things. You know, people will just tell you should delete an entire chapter. Like, with things, they're just not, they're just not within, like, the realm of possibility. And so I think it was a skill that I was sort of honing without even thinking about it just by being in workshops.
Right. Okay. So that kind of speaks to the importance of, you know, workshopping and going to workshops and everything. So that's a great tip. Go to workshops, writers. So I want to know, is the Turner House book that you started out writing, is it the same book that you ended up with? You understand what I'm saying?
In most ways, yes. The only, I think, thing that I did not necessarily expect is that I did not anticipate there being any sections in the past. I thought the book was very much going to be set during just like a couple of months in 2008. But the more that I researched about, like, the history of black people in the city of Detroit, I just got really fascinated, particularly with the Black Bottoms and Paradise Valley's neighborhoods as, like, sort of, like, you know, like, ground zero or, like, the landing spot for so many migrants from, like, the 20s through the late 40s. And my characters, the parents, they would have, like, absolutely been part of that community. So I decided to include sections that, like, made those neighborhoods that don't exist, like, make them exist in the fiction.
Right, okay. So the next question is one that I ask all of our writer guests, and that is, why are you a writer?
I have wanted to be and considered myself a writer since I started reading. I'm a writer now because I think, particularly, I think that black life is interesting, and that we really have only kind of reached, like, the tip of the iceberg as far as exploring in literature just all of the various, like, permutations and multifacetedness of black life in this country. And so I figure if I can contribute some stories to that, like, canon and help create that and help keep creating it, then that's what I'll do.
Excellent, and thank you for doing that. I love that. And you've gotten such wonderful recognition for your work, the National Book Award finalist, the New York Times Notable Book of the Year finalist for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize for Debut Fiction, and an NAACP Award. So as a first-time author, what have you learned about the business of being an author? You've gotten all those awards, and there's a lot that goes into it, but what have you learned?
Well, just to clarify, I was nominated for the Image Award. I did not win, but it's still, of course, an honor to be nominated. The thing that I've been doing since, like, my first workshop, even in college and undergrad, is that community matters. A lot of the sort of opportunities that I've gotten sort of outside of prize nominations have been because not because I was looking for anything, but I was supportive of other writers. I think that's the biggest thing, is that you can't just, you know, go to events with the hope that someone's going to notice you, but you really have to be there to try to also champion and experience and be part of a community of other writers. I think that's the biggest thing that has helped me.
That's such a wonderful point. Okay. Last two questions, right quick. And I understand that you have an appearance coming up in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, that next month around March 12th.
Yes, I'll be on a panel at the Midwest Literary or Voices of the Middle West, excuse me, is the name of the festival. And I'm on a panel with other writers about, is there such thing as the Midwest character? Like, is there a certain sort of consideration? Like, if you're writing fiction, do you have to think about when you're thinking about a character who lives in the Midwest, like, and how does that differ from other places? So I think that'll be pretty exciting, especially
since,
you know, I'm an outsider. I'm not from the Midwest, but I write about the Midwest. Like, that's something I've been thinking about since I found out about the topic.
Yeah, that is interesting. Sort of like an outsider looking in, having something to say about what goes on here, writing-wise. Do you have anything, a new story coming up or in the running around in the back of your head?
It's very early days. I'm hoping this summer to really get a block of time to really work on something.
Okay. Yeah, I know. It's like your one book comes out and people want to know, well, what have you got next? You're like, I'm just trying to breathe after having done the first book. Angela, what is your website? What's your website, and where can people find you online? And whoever is interested in your work, they want to know what's going on, how can they get to you?
Sure. My website is my name. That's Angela Flournoy. That's last name F as in Frank, LOUR, N as in Nancy, OY, just AngelaFlournoy.com. And then my Twitter is my name also, and everything is just my name, essentially. I think Facebook is Angela Flournoy Author, because somebody had already taken Angela Flournoy, but yeah.
Okay, very good. And that is that interview with Angela Flournoy. Again, check out her website and get her book, The Turner House. It's about an East Side Detroit story, and you can find that at her website, AngelaFlournoy.com, and her last name is FLOURNOY.com. And before we go, I've got a few events coming up in Detroit that I want to let you know about that you might like to attend in just a few minutes at 6 p.m. At the Detroit Public Library main branch. Onita Jackson will read from and discuss her book, Nappy-Headed Negro Syndrome, and that's at the Detroit Main Library right there on Woodward in the Midtown area, in the Cultural Center area. And tomorrow, June 23rd at 6 p.m., Amy Hamrill will read from her book, Detroit Hustle, Memoir of Love, Life, and Home. That's at Pages Bookshop at 19560 Grand River. And on Friday, June 24th, the Carr Center hosts The ABCs of Art presents Piper Carter, and she'll be talking about women in media. That should be an interesting conversation. That event is 6 to 9 p.m. at 311 East Grand River. That's the Carr Center, downtown Detroit. And Saturday, June 25th at 6 p.m., there is the Illuminate open mic featuring song, poetry, and music in the North End from North Enders and others. And the open mic is at John R. Rose Restaurant Patio, and that's at 9421 John R. in Detroit's North End. And that's it for this edition of Michigan Literary Network Radio. Remember to stay connected with Michigan's literary community through the Michigan Literary Network and Motown Writers Network at www.motownwriters.com, and you can find us on Facebook. And be sure to tune in to Michigan Literary Network Radio on blogtalkradio.com next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 to hear more literary good stuff. I hope you will be there, because I will. And my name is Andrea Daniel, and I'm here for Michigan Literary Network Radio. That's my name again, is Andrea Daniel. And I want to thank you out there for listening. I do appreciate you being there. And I want you to have a good rest of your night. Be a good story and write about it, or read someone else's good story. You all take care. Until next week, good night.